Thank you very much. So it's a great pleasure to be back. I do not know if this is working or not, but I'm going to assume it's working. So it's a great pleasure to be back in Toronto. It's, as Tom said, I have very fond memories of being here before. And I also wanted to thank you for coming out on a Wednesday night on what was it, inclement weather, right? It was 70 degrees in Texas when I left. Well, I didn't mean Celsius, yeah. So what I wanted to talk to you about is a little bit different than I think many of the talks you see in this kind in the seminar series. I think most of the talks that you see are more linked to financial engineering. This is more of a finance topic. And I think that there is really an opportunity for people with a quantitative background to make to work in problems in finance and make a difference there, because there's just so many problems in academic finance that are available that are not solved and that are, I think, not so difficult to address using quantitative techniques. So I'm going to give you an example of what I've been working on for the last few years now. It's not exactly, even though it is not, it doesn't have to do with derivative pricing, I think it's something that can possibly change the way we think about asset allocation and the kind of advice that people receive in terms of where to invest their money and so on. So I should mention that this is joint work. It's a couple of papers I will be talking about, so it's all mixed together, but it's work that I have been doing with Hervé Ross, who is currently in California, in a university in California at San Luis Obispo. Chunyu Yang, he's my student in Austin. Michael Gallmeyer is at the University of Texas, Texas A&M. And Hanjian Zhang, he's a postdoc at the University of Texas in Austin. So I do not know if you can hear me. I imagine you can hear me. Yeah. Okay, so the idea, and please, if you have any questions during the talk, please feel free to interrupt me. I know the culture is a little bit different in mathematics department than it is in business schools. I can tell you business schools, one expects to be interrupted during talks. And if one is not interrupted during talks, that means something. So please feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions. There's only one talk today, right? So, okay. Let me tell you how this project got started. I have an interest in exploring how relaxing some of the assumptions that you see in finance models changes the conclusions that one draws. And the assumptions that are the first that one can think of relaxing are assumptions that have to do with frictions. So I have worked in the past on problems where you looked at relaxing the assumption of frictionless trading, so look at what happens when you have transaction costs. I have also worked in problems where you are looking at asset allocation with having to pay capital gains taxes when you make a gain and receive a rebate when you don't. And this is another example where I want to look at financial constraints. And what am I thinking about financial constraints? I'm thinking about restrictions in terms of the kinds of positions you can hold because of either margin requirements or maybe borrowing requirements. Okay, maybe you are not allowed to borrow, or maybe you are not allowed to hold a position that is large compared to the amount of capital that you have. The budget constraint, the way that I understand budget constraint is that it just says that you just keep track of how much you borrow. So what I'm going to be doing here is I'm going to restrict how much you can borrow to be a multiple of your financial wealth, right? So I guess you can think of it as in terms of a budget constraint, although in the literature I don't think that's how people think of budget constraints. So going back to this idea of constraints, I'm thinking when are constraints most important? And the example that I think I want to stay for the rest of the talk today, the one that was motivating for me, was that if I think about who is most constrained in terms of investors, well, it would have to be investors that are young. Why would those investors be constrained? Well, these are investors that are going to be working, have a lot of years of work in front of them, and they cannot use all that future income to support trading. They cannot borrow against future income, and it comes down to they cannot essentially promise to repay. They cannot essentially promise to repay any losses they make in the market, because the polite way of saying it is human capital is inalienable. Slavery is outlawed, right? So you have a situation, if you are young, you have a situation where you would like to take a position in the market that can be very, very large compared to your current financial wealth, but would not be necessarily very large if you were to account for all the income that you will be making over the next 30 or 40 or 45 years. So these types of investors are going to be much more constrained in their actions compared to what they would like to do, compared to investors that do not have a labor income and do not have to and have worked most of their life, and now they have realized all that labor income. So there should be some difference, both in terms of the behavior of those types of investors and in the advice that one would give to these types of investors based on the point that they are in their life. In terms of general equilibrium, there should also be some impact on what we see that behavior translating in terms of asset pricing. If young people turn out to be holding certain kinds of assets, well, that's going to change the general equilibrium returns of those assets. So that's something that should also come out from this type of constraint. Now, when you want to talk about how people behave, then there is actually a literature that has developed and has looked at what kind of portfolios people hold. And this literature has largely attributed deviations from what's considered standard wisdom to behavioral biases. And when people say behavioral, they mean irrational, right? So why do young people hold undiversified portfolios? Because they're irrational, okay? What I want to try to convince you today is that even if people are rational, they may still end up holding undiversified portfolios. And one of the reasons for that might be the fact that they are facing the kinds of financial constraints that people typically face. All right, so that was the motivation. There is some literature on this topic. There is some literature on general asset allocation with frictions, and some literature that looked at asset allocation with non-negative wealth. There is not any literature that I know of that has combined financial constraints with labor income, and this is going to be what's going to be driving the results here. It's this interaction between the financial constraints and the labor income that's going to create different effects at different stages in the life of the investors that I'm going to be describing. So I'm going to skip the literature review. I'll give you a little bit of an overview of the empirical evidence. So the empirical evidence is the N bar is the mean number of assets that people hold, and there are different studies. So going back to 1995, there was a study that says that the mean number of stocks an investor holds is one. But if the investor is rich, then he holds 10 stocks. There are some other papers that have looked at this as well.
Is this taken over people who actually invest? Or
that's correct. This is people that actually invest. That's right. And I believe it does not. These are actually accounts that are not retirement accounts. So these are more of the what do you call the brokerage accounts, right? So there is also a differentiation in terms of how many assets people hold, in terms of how much money they have, what's their financial wealth. So you will see that people that do not have much money tend to hold fewer stocks than people that have more money. And finally, the last paper, the 2006 paper, that was part of the presidential address of John Campbell at the American Finance Association meetings. And the point there was that there appears to be some link between how diversified portfolios people hold and different characteristics of those people. So for example, age was a determinant. Young people hold portfolios that are less diversified than other people. So that's the empirical evidence. I'll give you a preview of the results. I've already been arguing that the constraints might influence the kinds of positions people are going to hold. What I'm going to try to show you is that the important factor that determines how diversified or undiversified the portfolio is going to be the ratio of financial wealth to the income of an investor, as well as how far, of course, they are from retirement. And that as the ratio of financial wealth to income becomes smaller, people will progressively hold optimally fewer assets in their portfolio. So you can rationally expect, people to literally drop assets from the portfolio if their financial wealth is small compared to their labor income. The result reaches an extreme if your financial wealth is very, very low, and the extreme is that you may end up holding just a single asset. And the single asset that you're going to choose is the asset that's going to offer you the highest expected return. So that's the preview. And I want to move on and talk about first partial equilibrium and then a little bit about what this would mean in a general equilibrium setting. What I'm going to be doing, I'm going to describe the partial equilibrium setting, provide you a continuous time model, and then give you some numerical results in a discrete time setting that will allow also for retirement. And then after that, I will move into the general equilibrium. Okay. So a little bit of a background. In the case where you do not have financial constraints, then you are in a situation that I guess by now can be described as classical. It goes back to Bob Merton and even before Bob Merton in the early 70s, late 60s. And it says that what you have in those situations is what's called the mutual fund separation theorem, which means that if you have different investors, without financial constraints, you have different investors, the only difference in their portfolios is what percentage of the portfolio consists of risky assets rather than what the composition of the risky asset portfolio is. So everybody holds the same composition of risky assets, and the only thing that differentiates people is how much of their portfolio consists of risky assets versus riskless assets. So people that are more risk averse are going to hold a bigger percentage of the portfolio which is in the riskless asset, whereas people that are less risk averse will hold a bigger percentage that is in risky assets. But the composition of the risky portfolio is going to be the same, irrespective of how risk averse you may be. Now, why is that happening? That happens because there's a very efficient way to scale up or down these portfolios. If you want to generate higher expected returns in this framework, what do you do? Well, you just buy more of the diversified portfolio of the risky assets that everybody's holding, and you just multiply the expected return by having this scaling that portfolio up or down. What is going to happen is that in a setting where you have financial constraints, you may not be able to do the scaling anymore. Right? You might hit a constraint, and once you hit a constraint, then you can no longer achieve this scaling that you would like. So you'd like to achieve a certain expected return. If you can borrow without any constraints, you just leverage enough and multiply the expected return of the market portfolio. But if you cannot leverage, how are you going to achieve that return? You cannot. So what are you going to be doing? Since you cannot leverage as much, you are going to now be in a situation of trade-off. You want to increase your expected return, right? You want to increase your return, but in order to do that, you have to start moving away from some of the assets in the market. And you have to concentrate towards assets that offer you higher expected returns. So, and that's what's going to happen. That's what's going to happen as the constraint becomes more and more binding, as the financial wealth of the investors is small. What's going to happen is that you will start, instead of increasing leverage, which you will not be able to do, you will start shifting towards assets with higher expected returns and changing the composition of your portfolio. And that's essentially the intuition. Here's a simple example, two periods. This happens even in discrete time, in very, very simple setting. Here's an efficient frontier, two assets. If you have no constraints whatsoever, what you do, you have the riskless asset, you choose the portfolio that is the tangent with the efficient frontier. But what happens is that as the ratio of financial wealth to income becomes smaller, then effectively it's as if the risk-free rate increases. So it's like there's a shadow risk-free rate. It's almost like you have a limited capacity of borrowing. And because you have a limited capacity of borrowing, there is a shadow price associated with the borrowing. So that effectively increases the risk-free rate. And if the risk-free rate is higher, you'll see what's going to happen. The tangent portfolio is going to change. Well, what's going to happen as you keep on moving this? Well, at some point, as the shadow risk-free rate increases, at some point the tangent portfolio will consist of a single asset. Which one? The one with the highest expected return. Okay? And then as the constraint bites more and more, you will still stay at that point. So what I'm saying here is that because the constraint can be thought of as a capacity of borrowing, and there is a price associated with the capacity because it's limited, you are going to see a shift towards portfolios which offer higher expected returns, but which are going to be consisting of fewer and fewer assets. So this is the intuition. And the same turns out to hold in continuous time as well. Of course, the example I showed you was kind of a toy example. I'll set up a little bit more sophisticated example in continuous time. So in this example, what I have is a model with two assets, two risky securities. I want to mention the results I'm going to talk about hold in the case of more than two assets as well. I'll just keep it to two assets to make it a little bit simpler. And you're going to allow a riskless bond, and I'm going to impose margin requirements. So what are margin requirements? Margin requirements are that you need to hold a certain percentage of what you are buying or shorting in terms of riskless assets in order to be allowed to do that. So in the way I'm going to set it up, the long positions, you can think of, if you want to buy a long position, you need to have 50% of the value of that position. Your wealth has to be at least 50% of the value of that position. For a short position, your wealth has to be, when you incorporate the value of the short position, 150% of the value of the position. So you want to short $100 of IBM, you need $50 because you're going to receive the $100 from IBM as well. If you want to go long $100 of IBM, you need $50 as well. So that is symmetric in that sense. And that regulation, it's interesting to see where these regulations come from. I will not have time to talk much about it. But those regulations were put in place by the Federal Reserve to avoid people defaulting. And it seems leverage is not all it's cracked up to be, although if you want to buy a house, leverage can be very, very high, right? Yeah?
Two risky equivalent risk?
I'm sorry?
Two risky.
The margin requirements are the same, independent of what the volatility of the assets are in this setting. You could have situations where you would adjust the margin requirements depending on what the volatility is. So the volatilities here are allowed to be, they're not constrained to the volatilities. But the margin requirements are the same for all the assets. There's only one margin requirement for going long and one for going short. Now, in real life, the margin requirements for stocks are the same irrespective of where the stocks are. However, there are assets which have lower margin requirements than stocks, like houses. Right? So what I'm going to show you is that if you allow for different margin requirements, what's going to become important, so this is a little bit of a preview, what's going to become important is the expected return of an asset leveraged to the amount that it's allowed. So if you have an asset with a low margin requirement, then that asset might be attractive because you can leverage that asset more than another asset with a higher margin requirement. So it depends. In this example here, I'm going to assume it turns the risk-free rate. But in reality, you would have actually a difference between the risk-free rate and what you receive in the short positions. And that difference is called the repo rate. And it can range between a few basis points to the entire risk-free rate. So it depends how large an investor you are. That's right. So I'm going to show you examples where I'm not going to allow shorting at all. And then in that case, there is no issue of what you earn on the margin account. Did that answer your question? Yeah. Okay. So Paul Whelan of the Federal Reserve in Boston, he has a paper that has looked exactly at the costs of shorting and the costs of maintaining a margin account. His conclusion was that for most individual investors, those costs are too large, and they would not want to be holding margin accounts because of the cost of trading in those accounts. So the results I'm going to be presenting hold even in the case where you don't have a margin account at all, and you have to put down 100% of the value of the assets you have to hold. So I'm going to rely on that literature to argue that it's costly for small investors to be managing a margin account, and I will rely also on the same to answer the question of why wouldn't people want to use derivatives instead of trading on margin. Derivatives are also going to be costly to trade for small investors. I do not know percentages though. Okay, now the labor income, I'm going to take a very simple example for the labor income. The labor income is going to be spanned by the risky assets, so it's going to be risky, but the risk is going to be possible to hedge if you could leverage. And I'm going to take an investor with constant relative risk aversion. And in terms of some parameter restrictions, the parameter restrictions are going to be very reasonable in the sense that, well, what do I want? First of all, I don't want the margin constraint to, I don't want to choose parameters such that the margin constraint will bind even if you don't have labor income. So that's one constraint. The next constraint is I don't want the demand for the risky asset to decrease as labor income becomes higher. Okay, so of course, if you have a correlation between the risky assets and the labor income, it's possible that as labor income increases, you want to actually decrease your exposure to the market for hedging purposes. Okay, so I'm going to impose a requirement on the parameters that that's not the case, because of course, if naturally you would want to less exposure in the risky assets if the labor income goes up, then it's natural that you wouldn't, the margin constraint wouldn't bind anymore. So I want to focus on the effect on the financial constraint. The objective is maximize utility from consumption, and if you have no financial constraints, what do? This goes back to Merton. What you do, you take your financial income, you discount it back to today. Sorry, you take your financial income, you put it on the one side. Then you take the projection of the labor income. You discount the labor income back to today. You add it to the financial wealth. You call the whole thing an effective wealth, and you choose an allocation based on this effective wealth. Okay, and that's the optimal portfolio. Now, that optimal portfolio might require you to hold risky assets that are many times your financial wealth. Okay, now, what happens if you have constraints? Well, if you have constraints, I need to introduce one variable, which is the effective relative risk aversion coefficient that has to do with the value function for the constrained investor. And what it turns out that happens is that this relative risk aversion coefficient changes as your financial wealth to income ratio changes. So what happens in the case of constraints is that you can separate the behavior in three different regions depending on what either your financial wealth to income ratio is or what this effective relative risk aversion is. And the first region is where the constraint doesn't bind, and then you hold everything. You hold everything in non-zero amounts, and then actually there you do hold the market portfolio. As the ratio becomes smaller, of financial wealth to labor becomes smaller, then you start having to drop assets. So in this case where I had two assets, you drop one. Sorry. You first get in the situation where the constraint binds without dropping assets, but you start changing within the portfolio, just changing the composition of these two assets, so you no longer are holding a micro portfolio. And finally, at some point, you drop one of the assets. Okay? So there are those three regions that characterize the behavior, and if you had n risky assets, you would have n plus one regions. Now, Mark Brody warned me to not use equations, so obviously I have gone over that. The optimal strategy, what are some properties of the optimal strategy? Some properties are obvious. For example, the positions in the risky assets are smaller in the case with constraints than without constraints. That's to be expected. Consumption is also smaller in the case with constraints. The reason that that happens is that the constraint effectively has a cost. So that cost gets incorporated in your effective wealth, and you are effectively not as rich as without the constraint. So that's why you consume less.
Can you just remind me why would the current value of your projected wealth, your projected labor?
If you don't face constraints, your effective wealth would be your discounted labor income added to your current financial wealth. I'm sorry, why is your labor income? I apologize. W is the wealth, why is the labor income? Maybe I should have used capital L. Yeah. So, the other thing that is interesting is that the asset that you are left with, the last asset that you end up holding, is the asset that has a expected return that is the highest among all the possible assets when you take into account leverage. So if you think of the situation, so if you have to adjust for correlation with labor, but if you think of the situation where labor income is actually deterministic, so it doesn't clearly fluctuate, then you see that the asset that you hold at the end is the asset with the highest leverage expected return. Okay. Now, why is that the case? Well, think of it this way. What happens is that, imagine that your position you would like to hold is many, many times the financial wealth, but imagine you cannot borrow. Then what's going to happen is you have a lot of appetite for risk. Of course, you want some compensation for it. You want some compensation in terms of expected return. You have a lot of appetite for risk, but you cannot take that risk. So now you increase your expected return by shifting your portfolio towards the assets that have higher expected returns. In doing so, you are taking positions that have higher volatility than they would have if you could leverage your your the diversified, the market portfolio. But in the end, the risk that you are taking in absolute terms is going to be smaller than what you would be taking if you could leverage. So in the limit, when you are extremely constrained, you don't longer care about what the volatility is of the assets. Doesn't matter how much the volatility is of the assets. It's not the Sharpe ratio that determines which asset you are holding. It's the expected return. So the asset with the higher leverage expected return is the one that you hold at the end. Yeah. Lambda is the leverage. So it's if that's right. So it's 50. Think of it as 50% for long positions. Yeah. Okay. So this was the theory. I want to talk a little bit about a numerical algorithm for solving this problem. So we thought of doing the following. We thought of doing an example in which we actually took data and tried to estimate what would people actually hold based on realized returns. So we took we went to the website of Ken French, and we downloaded the monthly returns of the portfolios that he has on five different industries: consumer, manufacturing, high-tech, health, and other, whatever other is. And what we did is we calculated expected returns, variances, and correlations using those five industries. In terms of the income, we used a drift and volatility that is consistent with what's in the literature in a paper by Luis Viseira. And here are the parameters. You have a copy of them. I don't want to mention here. If you look at the assets, one thing I should mention, this is data between 1920 and 2008. Okay, so you notice the interest rate is 1.4%. It turns out that's the historical interest rate from 1920. Okay, so it's obviously higher these days, but there was a lot of years in the 50s and 60s that it was zero. The other thing I want to mention is in terms of the expected returns. In terms of the expected returns, asset 4 has the highest expected return. Okay, so that's the asset that you will see being the most important one. Now, of course, there are correlations. So I now have a model with 5 stocks and income. And in order to solve this model, now this becomes a little bit complicated to solve because obviously I have to choose five. I have 5 choice variables, and I need to model the returns of the process. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be discretizing the distribution, and because the results that I have in continuous time are in the context of complete markets, I'm going to discretize the distribution of the returns in discrete time in a way that retains market completeness. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to use a decomposition that was proposed in 1990, in which you discretize an m-dimensional multivariate normal distribution with m plus 1 branches of the in discrete time, so m plus 1 points in discrete time. Okay, so that what that does is it retains the market completeness. Of course, it's not a very good discretization, so what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be taking a lot of time steps. Okay. Now, I'm going to be looking at cases where the income is actually spanned by the assets, so I will look at the deterministic case. I will also look at the case where the income is stochastic. Yeah. I do not need to assume a complete market. In my theoretical results, I did.
What theoretical
results? In the continuous time results. So in the results where I showed you before, those were properties that you can derive from the value function. When you have an incomplete market, then it's not. I do not know how to solve the problem. Yeah. So the numerical, I don't need to constrain the numerical discretization at all.
The simple emergence problem doesn't care about being in a complete market.
It is a complete market.
I mean, it just, you can solve the emergence problem in the complete market.
The problem is the labor.
Yeah.
the problem is the labor, it's not the assets. So the labor, if the labor is not going to be spanned by the risky assets, you may have to, I just don't know how to solve the problem. It's not a risky asset. So, how do you solve a problem like this? I mean, there's a lot of choice variables. There's not many state variables. Fortunately, there's not many state variables, but there's a lot of choice variables. It turns out the state variables, the only state variable that remains in this problem is the ratio of wealth to income. Okay? But in terms of choice variables, there's a lot of them. So the way we're going to solve it is we developed an algorithm. It's also, we actually adapted an algorithm from the literature. It's based on these ideas that were developed by Longstaff Schwartz and a few other people in the pricing of derivatives, American options. And the idea is you need to do dynamic programming, but you want to do it in a high-dimensional space. So what do? Is you set it up as a simulation model, and you approximate the value function by using a projection onto a set of basis functions. So we do the same thing here. We do the same thing here where we run, we simulate the expected returns, and we estimate the value function by running regression. Now the problem is that in the context of American options, all you need to do is you need to know whether you stop or you continue. In the context of this problem, you need much more. You need to know what positions to hold. So rather than trying to estimate all the possible positions you could take, what you do is you take derivatives. Okay, so you set it up as a Lagrangian. You set up a Lagrangian. You have to take care of the constraints as well. So you add the constraint. You add certain Lagrange multipliers. Multiplying the constraints is broken up. The constraints are the margin constraint, of course, and there is also the constraint that the I'm breaking up the asset positions in long position and short positions. So of course you cannot have a long position being negative or a short position being positive. So we have also Lagrange multipliers for those. And then what you do is you take derivatives. So you find a solution to the first order conditions. You have to add also the Lagrange multipliers in the problem. You find the solution to the first order conditions, and the solution to the first order conditions is going to give you the optimal allocations. So the way you do it is you approximate the value function using basis functions, then you take derivatives of that value function, and then you solve those derivatives equal to zero to find the optimal positions. So that's the modification that extends the Longstaff-Schwartz simulation algorithm to problems where you have a continuous choice variable. Okay. Now, I don't know. I have more slides on this one, but I don't think I will have time to get into them. But they should be at the end of your handouts where it says appendix if you are interested. What I want to do instead is I want to show you some results, and the results I'm going to show you. I looked at five cases. The first case is just a base case where income is deterministic and the constraint is just a margin constraint. The second case is I'm going to look at stochastic income, which actually is not spanned, is actually independent of the risky assets, because I want to see numerically if there's any difference between that case and the deterministic case. The third case, I'm going to look at a situation where the asset, the one of the assets is correlated with the labor income and see what a difference that makes. The fourth case, I'm going to impose stricter margin constraints. I will not allow any borrowing or any short sales. And then the last case, I want to look at a constraint that is a little bit weaker, is the constraint of not allowing negative wealth. You see, a margin constraint is much stricter than a constraint that doesn't allow negative wealth. You can have situations where you can have portfolios that are very large in positive and negative positions, but still do not generate negative wealth over the next period. Whereas if you are going to impose a margin constraint, the margin constraint is going to guarantee non-negative wealth. So I want to see what the difference is between non-negative wealth and margin constraints. Also because non-negative wealth has also been studied in the literature. So let me describe what this proof. They will not be equivalent in the continuous time neither.
Still different.
They are still different in continuous time. That's right. So let me describe what this picture has. In the horizontal axis, you have the ratio of wealth over income. This is for an investor at age 20. And you can see, for example, this would be the investor whose wealth is equal to his annual income. So income is in annual terms in this plot. So if you are thinking of an investor at age 20 that has, I do not know, say $40,000 Canadian dollars annual income, maybe that's too high for an age 20 investor. But such an investor, so this point right here would correspond to that investor having $40,000 of financial wealth saved. Okay, so you can see what happens is that the constraint doesn't bind when the initial wealth is very large, but very large really means very large. The investor, before the constraint starts binding, in this particular setting, the investor has to have wealth that's at least 1,000 times his annual income. So there are no investors like that, that I know of at least. Maybe they are, but I do not know them. Right. Now there are rich people around. So what happens is, as the constraint starts binding more and more, you see, you started from a situation where you're holding all five assets. As the constraint starts binding, the positions start getting smaller. First you drop asset 5, then you drop asset 3, then you drop asset 1. Eventually, if you don't have much money, you even drop asset 2. And then you just hold one of the assets, the one with the highest expected return, to the largest amount possible allowed by the constraint, 200% of your current wealth. Asset 4 was the asset, which one do you mean, which industry? Right, so this is 0% of your financial wealth. That's 200% of your financial wealth. Right. So this is an age 20 investor. Of course, as you get into older ages, the results are not as dramatic, because when you are older, you have fewer years remaining of labor income, and then the constraint is not going to be as binding. So the most dramatic results are in age 20. And this is the case where you have stochastic income, okay, uncorrelated with the market. So look, this is without stochastic, this is deterministic, this is stochastic, they are pretty much the same. So the, as you were asking me, Tom, what difference does it make in practice? None. Okay, so this is the case where you have correlation. So if you have correlation, now if you have correlation between the labor income and the assets, that correlation is going to generate hedging demand. In this example, I introduced correlation between the returns of the asset 4, which was the most desirable asset, with the labor income. So think of somebody that is working in the industry of asset 4, and that somebody, of course, is going to have, his income is going to be correlated to the returns of that asset. In that case, there are going to be hedging demands in asset 4, which will reduce that position in asset 4 to the extent of actually asset 4 not being the asset chosen. So in this setting, the asset that ends up being chosen is asset 3, because of the correlation with the risky asset. So you see there is non-monotone behavior here, where you have assets coming in and out. For example, if you look at asset 5, asset 5 is originally in the portfolio, then it drops out, then it comes back in. And this, of course, has to do with other assets dropping out and the need for keeping some sort of balance, of course, up to the point where the constraint becomes really binding, in which case you just hold a single asset. Okay? So
I don't understand. Income's only correlated with asset 4.
That's right.
So the other assets are not hedging anything.
But what happens
is, why wouldn't you just eliminate asset 4 and then the other ones drop out one at a time?
That's right. You do. You do eliminate asset 4. You see, the other asset comes in as asset 4 starts dropping out. So.
I don't understand why asset five would come in.
Yeah.
There's no hedging purpose for asset five, so what, it's an underperforming asset,
The way I think about it is that the combination 3 and 5, if you're going to be holding 3, you want to be holding 5, right? But so, but you don't do that while you're still holding asset 4. So it's just going to go back to the correlation matrix, which I have a really hard time understanding a 5x5 correlation matrix. Yeah. Does this help at all? I'm not sure. I'm not sure there's really much intuition to it. Other than correlated, when they have correlated assets.
The only difference between this and the previous slide was that you made asset 4 correlated with income.
25% correlation between asset 4 and the labor income.
I'm surprised that all this other stuff happened.
Right. Yeah. The way I understand it is that 3 and 5 go well together, right? And but 4 is to be preferred as much as possible. But as soon as 4 drops out, then you start. No. But, oh wait, I don't remember. Is it? Yes. Okay, sorry. I looked it up actually before the talk because I thought this would come up. Wait. Right, that's right. I mean, three has the highest drift. Yes, I think there's a lot of games you can play here, a lot of scenarios you can set up. I just look at a few of them. Yeah. Which one do you like?
The interesting case would be if you correlate it, the company gives you a preferred
right.
offering.
Right. Right. No, definitely. And then you have to wonder about. You have to wonder, I mean, there are all sorts of restrictions with those if you are going to be working for a company. For example, you cannot short the company stock, right? If you're working for a company, you probably don't want to be holding their stock. But then it's a good deal, right? Because they give you the discount or what have you. So all those things are going to play into it. This goes a little bit beyond the framework I have because I'm mostly dealing with margin constraints, right? So I'm not really dealing with being able to acquire an asset cheaper than otherwise and so on, or being essentially being forced to hold the long position in an asset. But maybe there's a way to do it. I have to think about that. Okay, so back to asset, to case number 3, I think it was. So the next case is the case where you cannot short and you cannot borrow. And in this case, you only hold 2 assets. You don't even bother with the other 3 assets. And that's even if you don't have labor income. Okay. Finally, I wanted to show you the difference with the case of non-negative wealth constraint. You still see this kind of asset selection. It's not to the same extreme as before. But what I want to point out is look at the size of these positions. Okay, before the size of the position was at most 200% of wealth. Now the size of the position, if you have very little financial wealth, can get to be more than 12 times your financial wealth. So you end up with a constraint on non-negative wealth. You end up with much larger positions than with margin constraints. Margin constraints are just stricter constraints. Okay. Now, empirically, what are the predictions? Well, young investors that have large income streams and a lot of years in front of them are going to be holding more, less diversified portfolios. Which stocks will young people hold? People will hold stocks or investments that offer the highest leveraged returns. What kind of investments are those? Those are investments with high betas. So internet stocks, say. Those are investments with low margin requirements, real estate. Okay? So the first thing you should do, buy a house. Especially right now, they're very cheap. But not last year. Then, I bought a house 2 years ago. Yeah. So, the other thing that comes out from here is that a variable that is really important to understand the degree of diversification is this ratio of financial wealth to income. So you want to study whether somebody is diversified or if it makes sense for them, rational to be diversified or not, you need to add this ratio as a variable in your study. Finally, there are other models that have these types of predictions of holding a diversified portfolio. So I told you I did work in the problem of capital, of optimal allocation when you face capital gains taxation, and then in that situation you also end up holding a diversified portfolio for completely different reasons, and there is no, in that case there is no difference between your different life stages, so they are completely different predictions. Very briefly, I think I'm short of time at this point. I want to talk a little bit about general equilibrium. So we've started working on a general equilibrium model, which is an extension of a paper that appeared in 2002 by Konstantinidis, Donaldson, and Mera. And the idea is you have a model where you have three overlapping generations, young, middle-aged, old. The young in the next period become middle-aged, the middle-aged become old, there's a new generation of young people coming in. And what we want to quantify is the impact of these financial constraints on the prices and the returns of these assets. So what is the intuition? What is the intuition? The intuition is that young investors are going to concentrate their portfolio towards assets with higher expected returns. In doing so, they are going to, through the demand for those assets, they are going to lower the returns for those assets. By lowering the return, they are not going to lower it to the extent that they don't want to hold them, but they will lower it compared to what the returns would be if they were not constrained investors. Then, what that's going to do is it's going to drive a wedge between the correlation of the returns of the assets that are young are going to be holding with the market portfolio, what you would expect the return for those assets would be based on the correlation with the market portfolio. So you will have an effect that is going to reduce the expected returns on the assets that are more risky, that have higher expected returns, compared to what you would expect based on the correlation with the market portfolio. So this could be a justification, if you want, or a partial justification, for the empirical studies that find that the relationship between the covariance between the returns of an asset with the market portfolio and the expected return of the asset is not very strong. Okay, so this is something that's going against the capital asset pricing model. So these frictions are doing that. Now, we do have some results that show that this is indeed the case, meaning that if you don't have constraints, you do get the capital asset pricing model or something very close to it. But when you have the young facing constraints, then you deviate. But it becomes difficult to interpret. When you have a nonlinear relationship between the covariance of the returns of an asset and the market portfolio and the expected returns of that asset, how do you even quantify the risk of an asset? It's no longer based on the covariance with anything, it's a nonlinear relationship, so I'm not sure how to interpret some of these results, but certainly it seems that the capital asset pricing model has to be adjusted to account for these kinds of frictions. So, this is my last slide. I already told you about the findings that we have about how young people or people with, it's not young people, it's people whose labor income is much larger than their financial wealth. Okay, how such people are going to optimally hold undiversified portfolios and how that can generate how that can have implications in general equilibrium. What I want to close with is I want to mention, also in the light of recent events, financial markets and financial portfolios are only a small part of what people do in life. The financial portfolios are not the only way that you can take risk. And what I want to leave you with is the thought that if you are young, and obviously you cannot borrow if you don't have any money to with the promise of your future labor income, but what you can do is you can choose a job that's much more risky. So if you are a young person and you are facing these kinds of constraints in terms of what you can actually achieve through financial instruments, what you can do instead is just choose a job that's very risky. Go work in Silicon Valley. But then on the other hand, has very, very high payoff in some of the cases. So you may end up, in order to overcome the constraints you are facing in the financial markets, you may end up making life decisions that you wouldn't necessarily make when you were 40 or 50 years old. Okay. So, I'm sorry?
You'll rest, young man.
That's right. So, okay. Thank you very much. What we could prove was that, well, let's call it proof. What we could show was that qualitatively, you will have these different regions. And in these regions would be determined by the ratio of your current financial wealth to your labor income. Okay?
It didn't seem to have much impact when you had a idiosyncratic component.
Numerically, it didn't.
Numerically,
that's right. But what happens, you see, in terms of the what it comes down to is you are adding an extra dimension in your in the equation you're trying to solve.